Okay, good morning, members. So I'm going to call Human Services Finance Policy Committee to order. Today, members, we have a full agenda of three bills. We're going to be hearing about funding for personal care attendants. And I'll talk more about that in a minute. First, we're going to do the roll. Ms. Hansen, can you take the roll?
Mm-hmm. Good morning, everyone. Chair Schultz.
Present.
Vice Chair Bonner. Lead Albright.
Good morning, present.
Good morning. Representative Bolden.
Present.
Representative Burkle.
Present.
Representative Fisher.
Fisher, present.
Representative Frederick.
Present.
Representative Hansen.
Hansen, present.
Thank you. Representative Keel.
Present.
Good morning. Representative Liebling. Representative Mueller.
Present.
Representative Moore.
Present.
Representative Novotny.
Novotny, present.
Thank you. Representative Pearson. Well, I see you, Representative Liebling. Good morning. Representative Pearson, present. Okay. Representative
Pearson, present.
Representative Pinto.
Present.
Thank you. Representative Rasmussen.
Rasmussen, present.
Thank you. Representative Robbins.
Present.
Representative Sandell.
Present.
Thank you. Representative Schumacher.
Schumacher, present.
Thank you. Chair Schultz, we have a quorum.
Thank you, Ms. Hansen. Let's see. Would Representative Mulder like to move the minutes from March 3rd?
So moved, Madam Chair.
Thank you. Representative Mueller moves the minutes from March 3rd. Any comments, corrections, or discussion? Seeing none, all in favor, please say aye.
Aye.
Aye. Any opposed? Okay, the minutes are approved. Thank you, members. So today we have two bills about personal care attendants. Tomorrow we're going to be meeting at 10:30. We're going to hear additional bills on personal care attendants. This is a huge crisis in Minnesota. We have a shortage of PCAs, and we have for a long time, and that pandemic has only made this crisis worse. So we really need to take action as a legislative body to increase wages and to improve the benefits for PCAs. It is very rewarding work, but it is also very important work and can be very difficult to find PCAs for individuals who depend on PCAs to improve their quality of life, to maintain their independence, but also to stay healthy. And often it could be a matter of life and death. So we have a lot of people in our caucus in the legislative body that are passionate about this and have been for a long time, including former Representative Jack Considine and the late Senator Rolf. And so I hope we can do something this session to improve the wages and benefits for PCAs, which is vital for our most vulnerable in Minnesota. So with that, members, the first bill for consideration today is House File 1434. And this bill will be laid over for possible inclusion in our Human Services Finance Bill. So Representative Frederick, please tell us about your bill. We have it before us.
Thank you, Madam Chair, members. As a former PCA myself, it was my job to take care of an individual with ALS or Lou Gehrig's disease, and he was fully paralyzed, and the only communication, only movement that he had is through his eyes. And so for his quality of care and to be able to communicate, there was an eye transfer board, and so he would look at different groupings of letters with his eyes, and that was how he communicated. And it was my job as a PCA to do the best I could to provide a high quality of life for him. And that's just my story. This bill funds a contract that covers 29,000 PCAs that have their own story about how they are working to improve the lives of the people that they're working with. So House File 1434, it increases rates for several home care programs to fund the contract recently agreed to between the state and self-directed home care workers represented by SEIU Healthcare Minnesota. The funding language is also carried in House File 1040, the Governor's Human Services Budget Bill. You should have the budget changes available to you. The contract is ratified by a different bill, which is House File 1685 from Chair Nelson, which is going to be heard tomorrow. This contract covers 29,000 workers. It raises minimum hourly wages from $13.25 to $14.40 on October 1st of this year and to $15.25 on July 1st of next year. It also improves worker training funds, PTO accrual, and holiday pay. The bill raises rates in three programs covered by the SEIU contract. They include the PCA Choice Program, where clients qualify for hours of service, and two budget programs, the Medicaid-funded Consumer-Directed Community Supports Program, or CDCS, and the state-only funded Consumer Support Grants Program, CSG. Because of federal requirements, the bill also provides a rate increase for the traditional or agency PCA program, where workers are private sector employees not covered by the contract. This bill increases the rates of CDCS program by 2.4%. It increases the rate of the PCA programs and the CSG program by 7.22%. This is a three times larger rate increase. In previous cycles, DHS has determined a common rate increase by calculating the average wage in all three programs. This year, they calculated the average wage separately in the CDCS program. They found that CDCS had a higher average wage and the PCA Choice CSG programs had a lower average wage. To meet the requirements of a higher minimum wage in the contract, they determined that the latter two programs needed a significantly larger rate increase because more workers would need a pay increase. I was glad to hear that DHS addressed these concerns raised last session by PCA providers. The total contract package costs about $70 million in this biennium and $106 million in the next. These workers predominantly are women and people of color. They've been frontline essential workers during the COVID-19 pandemic, risking their own health, almost always without adequate PPE or paid leave to quarantine. They have helped our elderly and disabled live at home and stay out of nursing homes and other institutions where COVID-19 has killed far too many. This rate increase is a small recognition of their efforts. I mentioned that the traditional PCA agencies will get the same rate increases. This will be very important for agencies with workers in Minneapolis. The Minneapolis municipal minimum wage for large employees is scheduled to increase to $14.25 this year and $15 on July 1st of next year. The rate increase will help traditional PCA agencies comply with the ordinance. Finally, I want to highlight this is a bipartisan effort. And Senator Miller has agreed to author the Senate companion to Chair Nelson's ratification bill. And I would like to thank everyone who has signed on to this and co-authoring this with me. With COVID, the mechanics of getting co-authors have been complicated, but I appreciate everyone who has been supportive. Thank you.
Thank you, Representative Frederick. And I know from our overviews, I hope members can remember the complication in our PCA system, where we have PCAs in the DWS system that are paid different wages and rates, and we have a different rate structure in our PCA traditional and PCA choice program and consumer-directed support programs. So it's very complex, and we need to, and when we hear Representative Lippert's bill tomorrow, hear about overhauling the whole rate structure so that's more consistent and PCAs can be paid using a similar rate formula across our various programs. So thank you for that introduction, Representative Frederick, and for carrying this important bill. I'm going to move to testifiers. We have Jennifer Claseman from MMB. I don't know if you're here to testify or to answer questions, but welcome to the committee.
Good morning, Madam Chair. I just have brief testimony this morning. Representative Frederick really covered all of the highlights that I was intending to cover, and I'll just give a little bit of background regarding the negotiations process.
Can you, Ms. Claseman, can you say your title and name for the record, please? Thank you.
Thank you. Jennifer Claseman, C-L-A-S-E-M-A-N. And my role is Enterprise Director of Labor Relations at Minnesota Management and Budget.
Please proceed then. Thank you.
Thank you. Under law, Minnesota Management and Budget is charged with negotiating the SEIU Healthcare Minnesota contract. And I really just will nip into the bud the overview that I was planning given Representative Frederick's has covered much of what we were going to discuss with you this morning. We had opened bargaining in October, so leading up to the preceding months to the legislative session, and wrapped in January after 11 sessions. We technically hit our 11th day of bargaining going into an extended session that began on the morning and then proceeded into the following morning, wrapping around 4 a.m. when we were able to reach a tentative agreement. This contract, if ratified, would be in effect from July 1, 2021 through June 30th, 2023. As mentioned, the highlights really do address the wage challenges that some employers were facing in the Minneapolis and St. Paul cities with the minimum rate that there are requirements with respect to the city ordinances. And the some of the additional funding provides training for the PCAs or individual providers covered under this agreement and improving their skills to provide safer and higher quality care for the individuals that are served by these programs. The increase in the PTO also allows workers that are covered by this agreement to be providing care on days that, or receiving pay on days in which their client that they serve are unavailable, such as in the hospital, or they themselves are unable to work. The wage increases allow the program participants receiving services from these individual providers to attract and retain workers all across the state in the home care field. Individual providers are providing care to our state's elderly and individuals with a disability with their daily living needs. It ensures people may adequately function in their home and that they have safe access to Minnesota communities all across the state. If there's any specific question with respect to the contract highlights, certainly I am available to take questions with respect to those.
Thank you, Ms. Klossman. We're going to move to the testifiers before we start questions from members. So the first testifier I have is Jacqueline Kelly. Jacqueline Kelly, welcome to the committee. Please state your name and affiliation for the record.
My name is Jacqueline Kelly. I am a member of SEIU Healthcare Minnesota.
Please proceed with your testimony. Welcome to the committee.
Thank you, Chair Schultz and members of the committee. My name is Jacqueline Kelly. I'm from Oakdale. I provide home care services to my 16-year-old son, Jack, who is autistic and suffers from major depressive disorder. I'm a member of SEIU Healthcare Minnesota. Our union represents 40,000 workers in hospitals, clinics, nursing homes, and self-directed care. On their behalf, I encourage you to support House File 1434. Jack's ability to live the life he wants is going to be dependent on PCAs. And if we're being honest, he won't want his mom as his PCA forever. Jack's ability to choose who will care for him will depend on what we decide to do today. As a parent of a teen quickly coming of age, one of the things I worry about is worker shortages. I worry that if we aren't able to provide a living wage, benefits, or a viable long-term career path, caregivers will choose to move into other employment situations that will provide more stability and less risk to them personally. One of the ways our contract addresses that is by a wage increase to $15.25 an hour. Our caregivers need to earn a meaningful wage that allows them to take care of themselves and their families while they take care of mine. If caregivers are stressed out and overworked and worrying about their ability to get by, it makes their jobs so much more difficult and the outcomes for their clients much worse. Our contract will also give us the opportunity to let new PCAs know about training opportunities like CPR and first aid, comprehensive skill building, and caregiver self-care. Our training programs need to be maintained so we can continue to develop better and safer working conditions for workers and better quality control for our clients. One of the big problems we face in home care is that people take these jobs without any real understanding of what is expected of them. Of course, this leads to high turnover, and part on the part of caregivers and creates great risk to the clients who depend on them. The most important benefit of training is removing the burden on clients to start at square one with every PCA they hire. If we don't take an investment in home care seriously, we are sending a message to our disabled and elderly community members who rely on this care that they don't have the right to decide for themselves what their quality of life should look like, and everyone should have that right. Taking care of the elderly and disabled is an issue that unites the members of this committee. I want to thank Representative Frederick and his co-author, Representative Davids, plus Senator Howe, for making this a bipartisan issue. We are proud of the bipartisan support we have gotten from so many over the years. Thank you.
Thank you, Ms. Kelly, for testifying today. Next person I have on the list is Brittany Wilson. Welcome to the committee. Please state your name and affiliation for the record, and then just proceed with your testimony.
Hi, my name is Brittany Wilson. I am a client of PCA Choice Services. And thank you to Chair Schultz, members of the committee. Thank you for having me here today. As I stated, my name is Brittany Wilson. I live in St. Paul. I work full-time. I am an active community member and overall enjoy my life as a proud, disabled woman of color. Many folks see me as an independent person, but what a lot of people don't realize is that the quality of home care that I receive daily is the biggest determinant of my independence. I have relied on home care services since I was a teenager, and I can definitively say that reliable and consistent home care is the reason I've been able to be so successful in a way that I choose. And that's what's so important here, that clients are able to utilize home care services to help ensure that their quality of life is the best that it can be, to ensure that they are successful in a way that looks right for them. We are all interdependent upon one another in some way, and that is no different for home care workers and clients. It is a relationship. The intimacy and bond created in this work is essential to feeling safe and supported, and that goes both ways. Fully funding the contract is a crucial step to make home care an industry that is viable to live off of, one that includes holiday pay, paid time off, training, and other incentives. At the end of the day, you are funding much more than a contract. You are making a statement. One that says home care workers deserve to be fully supported for their skills and labor. One that says clients deserve to be safe and have agency in our own lives. Without these services, I wouldn't be here today. And there are many who aren't here because of the inequities of this industry, which has only been exacerbated by COVID-19. Let us not forget that, and use this as an opportunity to do and be better. Thank you.
Thank you, Ms. Wilson, for your testimony. And thank you for sharing your experience. Let's see, members, do we have questions for the bill author or the testifiers? We also have individuals here from SEIU and DHS. Not seeing any member questions from members. Representative Frederick, would you like to make some closing remarks or comment on any of the testimony?
So since some of the people who have signed on support were named, I thought I would only give justice to Representative Albright. He has also signed on. It's just not posted online yet. So I wanted to make sure that I gave a thanks to him specifically as well. If anybody does have any questions, I'm happy to help. Thank you.
Okay, Representative Frederick, thank you for that. And thank you, Representative Albright. So you do have the budget change sheets, and Representative Frederick did note the cost. And so I'm just going to lay this bill over, House File 1434. Thank you for all the testifiers. The next item on the agenda is House File 1431. This bill will also be laid over for possible inclusion. And it looks like you have an amendment, Representative Frederick, a DE1. That is correct. So members, to get this bill in the shape that we need before discussion, I'm going to move the DE1 amendment to House File 1431. All those in favor of the DE1 amendment, please say aye.
Aye. Aye.
Any opposed? Okay, the DE1 amendment is approved. So Representative Frederick, please tell us about House File 1431 as amended.
Thank you, Madam Chair, members. House File 1431, I was approached about the need for PCAs to be able to provide transportation services to the people that they're assisting. And currently, they are not allowed to do so. And so if a person who is receiving PCA services, they might even own their own adapted vehicle, but which a PCA could use to transport them somewhere, that is not currently allowed. And so this bill would allow the PCAs to transport people to the grocery store, to clinics, to appointments in the community, whether that's, it could be recreational too, just to help out however. And so that made a lot of sense to me, and it was pretty easy for me to want to sign on and carry the bill and support that effort. And that's the whole goal primarily of the bill.
Thank you, Representative Frederick. I remember hearing about this issue several years ago, so I'm really grateful you're bringing this bill forward so individuals can be part of the community and we can reimburse our PCAs for that transportation piece that they're requesting. Okay, members, let's see, we have a few testifiers. The first testifier is, looks like it's Jeff Bangsberg is going to be reading a statement from Ted Stamp. Mr. Bangsberg, welcome to the committee.
Actually, I'm here.
Ted is here. Mr. Stamp is here. Thank you. Welcome to the committee. Please introduce yourself and proceed with your testimony.
Okay. Yeah, my name is Ted Stamp. I work for the Southwestern Center for Independent Living in Marshall. I'm an independent living advocate. And, you know, I'm really just one of the faces, one of the many people with a disability across the state that's affected by this issue. I've had to depend on others for my transportation since June 29, 1993. When I was an 18-year-old, my life was transformed forever when I had a spinal cord injury. I've been fortunate enough to have my own vehicle to get wherever I've needed to go since then, whether to the store or medical appointments, to college, to work, and social events like church. In all that time, I never had to wonder, nor did other people that I met with disabilities that I talked to, whether having our PCAs drive for us was allowed by a state statute. You know, it just seemed like common sense. And for the better part of 24 years, I and many others I knew, we took this for granted. Then one day in 2017, someone said to me, you know, you can't do that anymore. The state statute doesn't allow it. You know, I was like, state statute, really? So what's a person supposed to do? So soon enough, we found out what we're supposed to do. You know, and despite how unreasonable it seems and how frustrated it makes you feel sometimes, knowing you have your own vehicle, but you can't use it, you have no choice but to become dependent on the local public transportation system, which, you know, even if a community has it, is usually busy, especially in a rural location like Marshall, which has a great transit system, but it serves no less than 8 counties. So this often means being unable to get wherever you need to go, when you want to, if at all. It means limited options for scheduling rides in the evenings and on weekends, since there's no dispatch available at that time. It means having to send your PCA to the store with a list instead of going with them, which, as you can imagine, often winds up with products, you know, it wasn't exactly what you wanted because you weren't there to specify. Sometimes it means going to the store by yourself and only being able to buy as much as you can fit on your lap. And this for those of us privileged enough to have decent public transportation in a rural community like this, which much of greater Minnesota does not. Moreover, when people in this situation have to use Medivan services for getting to out-of-town medical appointments, does it make sense that the state should pay drivers of these vehicles at a higher rate than they pay and a PCA could be paid for doing the same job, especially since the PCA is often riding along anyway, which also means the state is paying for two people, driver and caregiver, when only one is really needed. Does it make sense that PCA should be prevented from driving their clients to the hospital or clinic when necessary, instead of using the public transit system, if it's available, or an ambulance, which again is going to come at a higher financial burden to the state? Lastly, under the present restrictions, how are such individuals supposed to visit out-of-town family and friends? You know, you think about special occasions like holidays, weddings, or funerals. And now with the COVID-19 epidemic, isn't it more crucial than ever that Minnesotans with disabilities have as quick and easy access as possible to the healthcare, which may mean the difference between life and death? And don't forget that allowing PCAs to drive their clients will inevitably alleviate the already overburdened public transit systems statewide for those who still want or need to use them. So thank you so much, Madam Chair, members of the committee, for taking the time to understand the important impacts of this issue on people with disabilities like myself, and for the honor and privilege of testifying today. Thank you.
Thank you, Mr. Stamp, for being with us today, and thank you for making such great points about why you support this bill. The next testifier I have is Vicki Jarrett. Please introduce yourself for the record and proceed with your testimony.
Thank you, Madam Chair. For the record, my name is Vicki Jarrett, and I'm the Executive Director of Minnesota First Community Solutions. As I stated, my name is Vicki Jarrett, but I'm here today representing the PCA Reform Coalition. The PCA Reform Coalition formed 3 years ago and is made up of advocates, associations, and providers who care deeply about the PCA program. Thank you for hearing the Reinstate Community Access for the PCA Program Bill, House File 1431. This has been one of our legislative priorities since forming. I also want to thank Representative Frederick for authoring this bill. House File 1431 makes a very small change to the PCA statute language that has a big impact for people who access the PCA service. It adds driving to the list of instrumental activities of daily living, or IADLs. When a person is assessed for PCA services, their disability-related needs for help with activities of daily living, or ADLs, are determined. ADLs are activities essential to living, such as dressing, grooming, toileting, bathing, eating, etc. The person needs need for help in ADLs is determined by an assessor, results in the amount of PCA service time that is authorized for the person. The assessor identifies if the person needs assistance with the IADLs, or instrumental activities of daily living. For example, preparing meals, shop for food or other essential items, help with laundry, or accompanying the person to participate in the community. If the person needs help with some or all of these tasks, the assessor just checks yes or no on the assessment. The PCA program does not provide any additional service time for accomplishing these IADL tasks. DHS does not attribute any cost to allow people to get help from the PCA for the IADLs. These tasks can be done within the service time provided for activities of daily living. I will repeat this important point. DHS does not keep track of the amount of service time or attribute costs to the IADLs. Currently, PCA providers are not allowed to bill for the time that the PCA is driving the service recipient. So in Mr. Stamp's example, if a PCA were to drive him in his vehicle, they're technically required to clock out and then clock in when they get to the destination and do the same on the return trip. There are several problems with this guidance, including that it's in direct violation of the Department of Labor. A PCA must be paid for all of their time, including time spent driving. The PCA agency is not allowed to bill for that time and yet must pay the PCA. This becomes yet another financial burden for agencies that have a current low reimbursement rate of just $17.80 an hour, to cover all the costs associated with operating a PCA agency. I personally know several people who use PCA services and have their own adapted vehicle, like Mr. Stamp. They need their PCA to drive them to work, volunteer opportunities, medical appointments, etc. So I ask that you support this small change and pass House File 1431. Thank you.
Thank you, Ms. Garretts, for your testimony. Cody Olson is next. Welcome to the committee. Please state your name and affiliation for the record and proceed with your testimony.
Thank you, Madam Chair and committee members. For the record, my name is Cody Olson. I am a policy advisor to the Minnesota Council on Disability. I've worked with the disability community advocating for legislation over the past several years, and this is a consistent issue that is raised with myself and with the Minnesota Council on Disability. We know that the PCA program is a top priority for the disability community, and anything that we can do to strengthen this program is very welcome for the community. And this particular policy change is a fantastic common sense opportunity to strengthen the PCA program. Importantly, the Council on Disability believes that this will advance the principles of the Olmsted Plan for Minnesotans with Disabilities, promoting more integrated community settings across the state of Minnesota. One other role that I serve is as the disability advisor to the State Emergency Operations Center responding to the COVID-19 public health crisis. And I have to share with this committee that reliable transportation is a huge challenge for the disability community in navigating this crisis. Particularly, I'm hearing stories about folks who are not able to get to testing sites or to vaccination appointments because of unreliable transportation. Because of these stories, I believe that this policy change will result in another tool for folks with disabilities around the state to access the essential public health services that they need to combat this pandemic. A few technical notes. We've asked the governor's office to provide this bill in his budget. And two other points I also want to touch on. First is one question that committee members may have is about insurance related to driving. And I would like to note that both the driver and the vehicle are required to have insurance. And so insurance is typically is not a concern for the authors of this bill. We also want to stress that this bill does not increase the number of PCA hours that are allotted to an individual client. We do expect that it would increase utilization of the already allocated hours. And with that, I'm available to respond to any questions that the committee has. Thank you for your time today.
Thank you, Mr. Olson, for your testimony. Are there any questions from members to the bill author or to our testifiers? We also have DHS available. I'm not seeing any questions from members. Representative Frederick, any closing comments?
I have to say it was really cool to see that I had a few emails just start popping up during the testimony here of different members signing onto these bills, which is awesome. Made me geek out a little bit. So I want to say just thank you for the support from everybody on the committee. And that's it.
Okay, thank you, Representative Frederick, for working on these important issues. Let's see, I'm going to lay the bill over House File 1431 to be possibly included in our Human Services Finance bill. So next, members, the last bill on our agenda is House File 1791. I know this bill is going to generate a lot of discussion, so I'm going to limit questions to one question and a follow-up from members, unless we have additional time or a comment from members. So first, I'm going to move to adopt the division report from Chair Gomez's Preventing Homelessness Policy Division. Please unmute yourself. This will be a voice vote. So all those in favor of adopting the division report, please say aye.
Aye. Aye.
Any opposed?
Nay.
The motion is approved and the report is adopted. Then I'm going to move House File 1791 to be re-referred to the Taxes Committee. Chair Gomez, your bill is before the committee. Welcome to the committee. I am so grateful that you've been able to do so much policy work on preventing homelessness in your committee. So thank you for that work. Thank you for your passion for this area, and thank you for working with our committee members in a bipartisan way to bring bills forward. So please tell us about your bill, Chair Gomez.
Thank you so much, Madam Chair. I appreciate being before the committee. It's funny that I'm a division of this committee and I'm not on it, so it's like good to see everybody's faces. So I'm gonna try to keep it a little bit more brief than I did yesterday. We had a great hour-long hearing in the division yesterday and heard a lot of testimony. But I'll just kind of walk through the bill pretty quickly. So House File 1791 is the Housing First for Kids Local Tax Aid. It takes a big step to address an issue that impacts families and communities in every corner of the state, child homelessness. So the reality for thousands of families across the state each year is that they have to do those basic things of parenting, keeping your kids safe, healthy, fed, get them off to school in the morning without having a safe and stable place to lay their heads. I think a lot of us are parents and many of us were parented. And so I just kind of try to keep that in mind, like, what is it like for those parents trying, you know, to give their kids the best, which is what we all want to do, when they don't have this like basic foundational necessity taken care of in their lives. So the cost of inadequate action on child homelessness is high. It shows up in many places in our systems, in the opportunity gaps of schools that we talk about a lot, in utilization of public services, and in just the sheer human cost. I was really shocked when I started doing research on this that fully one third of all of the people who are homeless in Minnesota in a year are children under the age of 17 with their parents. So they're like 18 or 19% of the population, little ones are, and are 30% of the homeless population. The other thing that I found was that, like, if you are homeless when you're a kid, your likelihood of being homeless when you're an adult goes up dramatically. So this is from Wilder Point in Time Count. Half of adults surveyed became homeless by the time, had their first episode of homelessness by the time they were 24. And one third of the those who were surveyed as adults who were homeless had an episode of homelessness when they were a kid with their family. So making sure that, you know, that families in our house are in our state are stably housed and making sure that they don't fall off that cliff into homelessness is one of the best targeted interventions that we can do. So the Housing First model is really something that just, a way of intervening in homelessness that acknowledges that without a home, every other part of life is virtually impossible. So we can't be requiring like that people get a job, go through all these programs, and then they get a house, right? It's really about providing two kind of pillars of support, one of which is rental assistance and the other of which is supportive services that help people to get into homes and stay in homes. The Housing First for Kids local aid to counties would help up to 10,000 students each year who are or are in danger of becoming homelessness. We have this funding is not going to go to Minnesota Housing's Homework Starts with Home program, which you'll hear about, but we really modeled this approach on that program. In making it a tax aid, it made sense to send the funds to counties who are across the state of Minnesota play a really important role in providing services to those experiencing homelessness. So just briefly walking through the bill, Subdivision 2 establishes the program's purpose. Subdivision 3 speaks to allocation of funds. We base that on the Minnesota Department of Education does a survey and collects data on where students experiencing homelessness are in Minnesota. So each county gets an allocation based on that. Subdivision 4 is kind of the meat of the bill that talks about how the funds are to be used. You can kind of, you can read through that section. Again, you know, it's really rental assistance and supportive services and case management to help improve housing stability. Subdivision 5 talks about how and when the allocation to the counties will be made, which comes through the Department of Revenue, which is where we're going to taxes next. And that's the bill. I have a couple of testifiers. And then I'm open to any questions.
Thank you, Chair Gomez. Eric Grumdahl, Welcome to the committee. Please state your name for the record and then proceed with your testimony.
Thank you, Madam Chair and members. My name is Eric Grumdahl. I'm the Deputy Director of the Minnesota Interagency Council on Homelessness. And if it's okay, I've been asked to just share a little bit of background about student homelessness in Minnesota. So I'll just share a couple of slides with you. Hopefully you can see that slide now. The Interagency Council on Homelessness is a cabinet level body led by the Lieutenant Governor. It includes all of the agencies that you see on your screen, and its purpose is really to help drive state responses to prevent and end homelessness, and in that has catalyzed a number of important initiatives and efforts, including Homework Starts with Home, really as a partnership between Minnesota Housing and the Department of Education at a state level, along with lots of relationships with philanthropy. In terms of student homelessness, there are a number of ways that we've looked at student homelessness, and this picture, I think, really helps confront one of the common misperceptions about student homelessness. It is really widely distributed. And so on the map you see on the right side of your screen, the every dot represents a school where a student experiencing homelessness is attending that school. And I think the scale is also one of those surprises that people often find, is that on October 1st of 2019, there were over 9,000 students identified that were attending schools in Minnesota that day. These are public and charter schools attending school on October 1st. When we look over the course of an entire school year, that number generally doubles. And so in terms of distribution, we see that as you see in the red dots as well, 77 of Minnesota's 87 counties have schools that have identified students experiencing homelessness. We also see significant disparities in homelessness in general in terms of who experiences homelessness, higher rates of homelessness among LGBTQ students, students with disabilities, and BIPOC students. Here's a dive into just those racial and ethnic disparities in terms of which students experience homelessness. The green bars are the homeless student population. The blue bars are the entire student body in Minnesota. And so we see that the Hispanic, Black, and American Indian students are significantly overrepresented in that student population. Again, that parallels what we see for adults experiencing homelessness as well. We've also seen, really following national trends, a remarkable increase in the number of students experiencing homelessness over the last decade. And so these are, again, just that October 1 of each school year count, going back to the 2007-2008 school year. And again, when we think about the number of students that districts are identifying, so these are often the designated staff people within a district who are responsible for providing homeless students with the supports to keep them in school, including transportation or other kinds of assistance. We see that those McKinney-Vento liaisons, they're often called, often identify twice as many students over the course of an entire school year. There is really profound research on the impacts of homelessness and the risks that it exposes students to. I think one of the most dramatic ways that we can see those impacts is the graph on the right. These are third grade math proficiency scores. The bottom two segments of each bar graph are essentially doing well enough, either meeting or exceeding the proficiency standards for third grade math. And when we compare all students to students experiencing homelessness, we find that students experiencing homelessness are less than half as proficient, less than half of that student group is proficient compared to the general student body. And so these are, I think, one of the really troubling pieces that the research has documented is that without intervention, these disparities really persist over many school years. And so really contributes to the challenges with closing some of the achievement gaps that we see. But as noted on the left side of the slide, lots of impacts in other ways as well. I also know that school mobility is a significant challenge for many students, which isn't really a surprise when they're experiencing homelessness, but may be notable given that there are specific protections to help students stay in their school of origin. But even still, we find that students experiencing homelessness have far greater degrees of student mobility of school mobility within the course of a single school year. And that we know contributes to, again, some of the challenges of meeting those proficiency standards or being able to complete their kind of academic goals. The other thing I should have noted on the math proficiency slide is that we see almost an identical pattern for reading. And so that was math, but reading looks essentially the same. And so again, really profound impacts. With that, we'll hand this back to you, Representative Gomez, and happy to answer any questions. Thank you.
Thank you, Mr. Grumdahl. Representative Chair Gomez, would you like me to proceed to the next testifier? Okay. Matt Hilgart, welcome to the committee. Please introduce yourself and proceed with your testimony.
Thank you so much, Chair Schultz. Good morning, members. My name is Matt Hilgart, and I represent the Association of Minnesota Counties. AMC represents all of Minnesota's 87 counties. I want to thank Chair Gomez for her authorship of the bill in front of members today and for her committee's bipartisan work and interest in responding to the homelessness crisis in Minnesota throughout this session. As county testifiers aptly stated in her committee yesterday, homelessness does not occur in a vacuum around the metro. Homelessness is a statewide issue that requires a statewide solution. And Madam Chair, I hope you don't mind, but I did reach out to your committee staff to insert into the record one letter actually from your district, St. Louis County, that really shows that this is an issue that hits greater Minnesota as well. I also want members to know that counties are already playing an important role in this critical area. In Ramsey County, the Board of Commissioners work with staff to double their Project Home shelter spaces for families experiencing homelessness and expand hotel room access during the worst of the pandemic. They have also invested in long-term resources with nonprofit partners such as the Sisters of St. Carondelet Village at St. Kate's University that provide safe space for families and youth. In Dakota County, the county operates their own youth shelter with studio apartments accommodating up to 24 youth and teaming up housing security with 6 full-time county staff members that work on case management services. They also spend significant dollars each year partnering with local churches as alternative housing sites for youth during the coldest months of the year. In the last 5 years alone, the county has quadrupled the amount of budget resources they dedicate to combating homelessness. And in Stearns County, the board has put together a home team dedicated to finding housing for people experiencing homelessness throughout Stearns County. Since March of 2020 alone, the county staff and nonprofit partners have been able to house 98 individuals. After first glance at this bill, we would share the following first impressions and thoughts that we respectfully put out to the committee for further discussion and collaboration. First, we appreciate that the language allows counties to collaborate with other local governments, regional partnerships, and community-based nonprofits. Critical to fulfilling the goals of this legislation will be for counties to assess quickly and honestly who is in the best position to provide assistance, outreach, and support in their communities. For some counties, it might be county staff themselves. In many others, it might actually be, especially for our smaller, greater Minnesota counties, it might be teaming up as regional forces. And certainly in all cases, it will be teaming up with community partners. Regarding the formula, we have a couple questions related to what the formula would look like in allocations, how dependable funding streams are year to year, and what happens if a county doesn't create a project, where would the funds go, back to the state or redistributed among the remaining counties doing work? The bill's allocation formula is strictly tied with MDE data. And as mentioned above, we are interested in how this data is collected, how reliable it is, and if it includes homeless individuals in the 18 to 24 range who might not be counted unless they were enrolled in some kind of educational programming. These again are only our first thoughts and in no way diminish our support for being involved in assisting and the author's intent. Recentering my remaining remarks on the merits of the bill and what folks have said to me in the last few days of getting feedback. Olmsted County said, "We love this idea. There's nothing more sad than hearing about a child who goes to school with your kids that has no place to call home." Right now, the county spends a significant amount of time and energy on applications for services to apply for grants. If funding was tied to bases, to areas based on need, that would save us a lot of trouble and give us a dependable funding stream to put energies where they belong, actual services and work rather than grant writing. Sherburne County. The county participates in the Becker Homeless Prevention Work Group, which has good partnerships with schools, neighboring counties, communities, and nonprofits such as Open Doors for Youth in Elk River, who are already providing services and a day shelter for homeless youth in our community. If we were fortunate enough to obtain this additional funding, we would have ample opportunities already available to put in place to structure programs. Yellow Medicine. This down in the Southwest Minnesota. The county has had very few homeless youth that we know of in the past few years. When we have identified them, the county has tried to be as creative as possible to provide assistance within our current structure. This usually comes in the form of food, gas cards, or bus passes. That said, we have had homeless youth over the years that have fallen through the cracks. As a smaller county, we would likely support an outside organization that already has a structure in place like Prairie Five, or Lutheran Social Services, who are already running programs that cover the costs of sheltering individuals at local hotels. These funds may actually help support moving youth and or family into permanent housing rather than short-term relief. Otter Tail County, funding to pay for these critical services is very hard to obtain. It's not offered on a regular basis and it is highly competitive. Otter Tail County would likely partner with their local community action agency, Mahube Atwa, who has experience and expertise that would be extremely beneficial. And lastly, Maurer County, and speaking to our Health and Human Services Director, she thinks this bill is excellent. And if we were to receive any funding, we would bring together our mental health collaborative, our schools, Salvation Army, and any other resources to create a 360-degree approach. So what you hear here, members, is partnerships that are already in place, that we already have communication with, and that we're ready to go. We will continue to survey our membership and try to provide the chair and committee members with feedback and suggestions. And in closing, we really thank Chair Gomez for the authorship of the bill, for frankly the bipartisan interest in homelessness issues this session. I don't know that there is much more of a noble goal than ending youth homelessness, and the bill in front of members is a bold and a new approach. As I mentioned to the author in earlier correspondence, counties are entering this discussion with humility. We're wanting to help, but we're also wanting to make sure that we can meet the expectations of this legislation and serve youth and family experiencing homelessness in the best way possible. We stand ready to help you and the legislature achieve these goals. Thank you very much, Madam Chair.
Thank you, Mr. Hilgart. We really appreciate the overview from Mr. Grumdahl and your comments and sharing testimony from the various counties. Representative or Chair Gomez, would you like to address some of the questions from the testifiers?
If we could just move on to, Madam Chair, to Mr. Baumtrog to just tell us a little bit about the program that exists that we sort of modeled this on, and then we could go on to member discussion, that would be great.
Thank you, Chair Gomez. Mr. Baumtrog, and please introduce yourself for the record.
Great, thanks, Madam Chair.
And your testimony.
Madam Chair, members of the committee, my name is Ryan Baumtrog, and I'm the Assistant Commissioner for Policy and Community Development at Minnesota Housing Finance Agency. As Chair Gomez mentioned, I'm not here in support of House File 1791, but rather am here to raise awareness of the governor's recommendation for a $1 million increase to the Homework Starts with Home program, which the bill in front of you is modeled after. So the governor is recommending a $1 million increase to that program to bring it to a $4.5 million program statewide. As previously mentioned, the program Homework Starts with Home provides rent and housing assistance to families with school-aged children that lack housing stability. The program also encourages wraparound services and, as mentioned already, community-based partnerships. The program's about stabilizing the whole family so that kids know where they're sleeping at night so they can show up to school the next day and hopefully do their homework, and so that adults can worry less about where they're sleeping and can focus on their jobs, education, and health. This is a relatively new program at Minnesota Housing Finance Agency. It was funded with some one-time appropriations starting in fiscal years 2014 and 15, and was recently added to the agency's base budget with the budget for fiscal years 18 and 19. The agency, in partnership with the Department of Education, evaluated this program and found that it was very effective. For those families that received housing assistance, the kids showed up more to school and parents' incomes increased. This isn't all families' experiences, certainly, but some went from being homeless to homeowners in 2 years after getting rental assistance through the program. Overall, about two-thirds of the families that entered the Homework Starts with Home program were homeless when they entered the program. A little bit about who the program currently serves. The annual household income for the family served with Homework Starts with Home is about $8,000, which is around 9% of the statewide median average for income. The amount of housing assistance that's provided ranges per family based on their need and what's identified for the individual families, but it averaged out to be about $5,500 per year to help provide the housing stability that they need. And two-thirds of the households serve identified as Black, Indigenous, and people of color. With the current program, we have 8 grantees that serve a number of regions across the state and really relate to Mr. Hilgard, as he mentioned, the counties. Many of the counties he mentioned are partners in some shape or form with the current grantees. So there are programs in Northwest Minnesota, West Central, Southeast, and in the metro in Hennepin, Ramsey, and Washington County. And all of these programs are collaborations between housing providers, specifically identified schools, and then typically the county in most of the grantees. Around full implementation of the resources we currently have, we estimate around 900 households will be served through the program. I thank the committee for time to talk about the governor's recommendations for the Homework Starts with Home program, and I'm available for any questions.
Thank you, Mr. Baumtragen. Sorry, I didn't have you on my list of testifiers, so I apologize for that. I don't have any more testifiers. Representative Gomez, if it's okay with you, we will move to members' questions. And so members, like I said, I'm gonna limit initially the number of questions, but we have 30 minutes, so we have time to circle back to members if they have more. Representative Albright.
Thank you, Madam Chair. This first question actually is for you about process, and you and I have had a couple of conversations, but I do think it's important to put it before the public in terms of an understanding. Now, yesterday, this bill was heard in homelessness at the same time as we were convening our committee yesterday. And so if we were, and I have an amendment, it's the DE1, and it's before the committee, it's on the agenda. In light of the timing of the homelessness committee division hearing yesterday and having it re-referred to our committee yesterday, our deadline for amendments would have been at 10:30 yesterday. How do you view the ability for anyone, either in the majority or the minority, to craft amendments knowing that the bill, not knowing the structure of the bill until we would have been past deadline and actually still have been in committee during yesterday's session?
Thank you, Representative Albright. So the bill was posted 72 hours in advance earlier, and you had time. You knew it would be pending referral. Your DE amendment, since it deleted everything in the existing bill, really wouldn't change if changes were made in Chair Gomez's committee. We did have a conversation about this. I'm trying to be as fair as possible, but also to respect our other members on the committee so they have time to look at amendments and time to caucus the amendments. So since this is a DE, I don't think it's as relevant about the timing of when it was delivered to our committee, because we did put notification out to the public and to members that we would be hearing this bill. And it's, I believe your DE is the same amendment that Representative Ann New Brinley brought to Chair Gomez's committee. And they did have a discussion, and we can have the discussion and talk about your amendment, but we're not going to formally offer it today. But we have plenty of time to discuss your concerns and get those concerns out in public, and to have Chair Gomez and the testifiers answer as many questions as we can get to.
Madam Chair, I think it's troubling for this committee As I've heard from other members in correspondence, that we cannot do the work that this committee is charged with, that we are in years past, this committee has done strong bipartisan work on issues that directly deal with the folks that are in the shadows of life. And I find it troubling that we would not want to undertake a strong consideration of doing the work that this committee is charged with, rather than absolving ourselves of it and directing it onto tax committee because of a provision in an amendment or in the bill itself that somehow obligates the tax committee to undertake amendments. I find it very troubling, and my committee members on my team and my caucus are certainly very concerned about the timing as well as the rush for an issue such as important as this one. That being said, I will ask two questions, as you've said, and a follow-up to Representative Gomez. Representative Gomez, when I'm looking at your bill, the first thing that I draw my attention to is in terms of what was just said by the testifier, you have the homework starts at home, and that is an established program. So first and foremost, why are we not emphasizing that program since it's already existence? And then if you plan to move forward with this new program, why are there material differences that can't be incorporated into the existing program?
Chair Gomez.
Thank you, Madam Chair. Just if I may, I want to comment on something that Representative Albright, just that you said earlier. There's not like a little provision in here that sends us to the tax committee. This is a tax aid. This is a bill that does not come out of the human services target. This is a local aid to counties, and so it's very much in the jurisdiction of the tax committee. So what I've found in my committee so far, it's interesting. And honestly, so the reason that my division meets at the same time as this committee is because initially I was a division of housing and then got switched over here. So kind of everything about this points to the reality of funding homelessness services, which is, it is homelessness by its nature is a very complicated policy area. It is cross-jurisdictional by nature. You and I kind of spoke earlier and you're like, oh, does this need to go to education because it impacts education? And I'm like, well, I mean, it could, I guess. It could go to housing, it could go to human services, it could go to education. Because the way that we fund our homelessness response comes out of a number of different agencies and departments. So to your question, the Homework Starts with Home program is a program of Minnesota Housing. It serves less than one-tenth of the students who are homeless across the state of Minnesota in a year. It's based on an estimate, of course, right? We know that we're missing other kids to Mr. Hilgard's point. We do a lot of different things in the tax code with respect to investing in different priorities. So for example, we could go down the line, right? But just on housing, we spend $100 million on the mortgage interest deduction each year, which is only for filers who itemize their deductions, which means that it's really for very high income people. And it's housing policy and it's in the tax code. And so the reason the target for housing in 2019 was $20 million. This bill is a $55 million annual investment, which actually reflects the scale of the problem that we're trying to address. And we deal with really big issues in the tax committee. We deal with issues related to business, related to healthcare, related to housing. And I believe that we need to not just help the we don't need to just use the tax code to help the most fortunate among us. We can use the tax code to help people who really need a helping hand in a way that maybe eclipses the scale of what's able to be accomplished via a program like Homework Starts with Home. And so, you know, that's sort of just like the kind of budgetary reality that we're existing in. And maybe that's like not a great answer, because it's sort of like, you know, you could argue that this should be a direct appropriation, but like, how is that going to happen? How are we going to meet this need is the question. And so for me, you know, I'm chairing this little division, and I'm trying to find any way by hook or by crook to make sure that people in our state are not homeless. And to me, the reality and the costs of allowing children to be homeless in our state necessitate any response that can actually get done. And this is something that we can actually do.
Thank you, Chair. Yep, thank you, Chair Gomez. And I just want to make one more comment. You know, the work of this committee, a lot of it happens when we're not meeting during committee time. And I expect members to work together in a bipartisan way to improve bills. And that has to happen outside the committee as well. And I expect, and I asked Representative Albright to work with Chair Gomez before it gets to the next committee stop, which is the tax committee. And I hope they can work together in a bipartisan way, because we are all concerned about our unsheltered youth in the state of Minnesota. And the DE amendment that Representative Albright would like to offer cuts that funding and limits it to 2 years. And so I hope that they can work together in a bipartisan way to come up with some compromises so we can fund more shelter and stabilize our young people's lives so they can be successful. I mean, housing stability is so important for health, and it's a social determinant of health, and we need to be serious about it. And that's why we have a division. That's why Chair Gomez is working on this issue with her members. Representative Albright.
Thank you, Madam Chair. Well, you know, I'm certainly endorse the idea of working in a bipartisan fashion and anticipating bills, but candidly, Madam Chair, this bill was introduced on Monday, and it was heard in homelessness on Wednesday. We're hearing it on Thursday, and so, you know, timing in terms of working outside of committee on other bills, certainly appreciate your suggestion and your strong words on that, but in this case, this is really the first opportunity outside of homelessness yesterday that we've had a chance. We all are involved in many other issues, and that's not an excuse. Homelessness is an important one. But to suggest that, you know, we should have been working on this in advance, I would have welcomed the opportunity to talk to Representative Gomez on this idea prior to it being introduced. And to the point of the amendment, it makes fundamentally just two changes. Even though it's called a DE, it really fundamentally makes two changes. It changes it from an ongoing appropriation to a pilot program, and it reduces the proposed funding. The insinuation that it cuts the funding, I think I would correct that to say it's reducing the proposed funding from 55 million to 25 million, and it requests a report. No one argues the idea that homelessness is a grave concern that should be on the minds of everyone in the state. But let's make sure that the effectiveness of the program is inculcated into the program from the onset, and we don't have to remeasure it after the fact. That's why I think the reports back to the legislature are so important. And I would might add that Mr. Hilgart's comments certainly reconfirm and actually support the provisions in the amendment itself. That being said, my final question for Representative Gomez, and then I will request concluding remarks at the end of the conversation, is with regard to the appropriation itself, Representative Gomez, how was the $55 million appropriation arrived at?
Thank you, Representative Liebling. Chair Gomez.
Thank you, Madam Chair and Representative Albright. So you noticed that in The presentation that we heard from Eric Grundahl, he talked about the numbers that of homeless youth that are counted under the McKinney-Vento Act. And so what we decided to do was kind of take that number and the number that Mr. Baumtrock talked about, which was the per household investment in Homework Starts with Home. And so that's how we got to 55 million. I mean, it's a little bit back of the envelope. And what we know is that the McKinney-Vento Act requires that there are two collections of data. One is, I believe, early in the year, maybe in October, I think they were saying. And then one is in April. And so when I spoke to practitioners, actually what they told me was that those first numbers, those October numbers, are really not accurate. You really need to look at the April numbers, because through the year, sort of teachers get to know kind of more about what's going on with their students. So honestly, this is probably not enough money to actually address all of the households where there are children experiencing homelessness. But the way that we got to 55 million was we took the $5,500 investment that is the average from the Homework Starts with Home program and said we want to serve 10,000 students, which was roughly the number that gets counted in McKinney-Vento across the state of Minnesota annually.
Thank you, Chair Gomez. And I apologize, I may have referred to Representative Albright as Representative Liebling. Just shows my lack of sleep. So I apologize for that, Representative Albright and Liebling. And we will circle back to you, Representative Albright. Representative Pinto.
Thank you, Madam Chair, and thank you, Representative Gomez. This is just an absolutely terrific proposal. I had one question about it with my narrow focus on the youngest kids. I was just curious. I noticed that line 2.1, the focus is on families with children who are school age, which would include pre-kindergarten, and just wondered if kind of what your thinking was, knowing the huge impact on infants and toddlers and 0 to 3 as well, if there was a deliberate decision not to include that, or kind of what your thinking was.
Chair Gomez.
Thank you, Madam Chair, and thank you, Representative Pinto, for the question. It's a really good point. Actually, yesterday in the division, we were lucky enough to have Dr. Ann Mastin, who from the University of Minnesota, who studies, kind of the impacts of homelessness on cognitive development, academic achievement, but then she also talks about kind of trauma and resilience and risk, right? And so she gave us a really great presentation about this. And when we were having our kind of pre-discussion, she was like, you have this program that targets E12, and we know how much happens before that. She's like, the science that's emerging is even telling us that one of the best times to provide an intervention is during pregnancy, to make sure that, people who are pregnant are not experiencing the stress of housing instability and displacement while they're doing the work of growing a human in their body. And so honestly, for me, we started with this because we have this really effective program that's running in Minnesota housing. And my original idea was like, how do we scale that program up so that it actually like can serve all of the students who would be eligible for the program under its guidelines? And so I guess I would say that what we know, right, is that for children of any age, and especially in those early years when so much development is happening and like the home environment and the sort of richness of the what's happening around the little one is so important. Like we know that we need interventions there too. We know that we need interventions later in life for people, because actually like nobody should be experiencing homelessness. Like everybody should be able to have a place to stay and a platform from which to launch their life. So this is limited, but just to go back to something that Representative Albright said, just in terms of like evaluating the program. I mean, we do have, and with Homework Starts with Home, we have this partnership that's in place between the University of Minnesota Institute of Child Development and the state of Minnesota that's evaluating the outcomes of this program. And so frankly, my hope is that we're going to be able to show how effective these investments are and to be able to scale it up so that we're serving all children in Minnesota of any age.
Thank you, Chair Gomez. Representative Pinto, follow up.
I do, Madam Chair. Thank you. I guess as I look at the use of proceeds, I had the impression that although Homework Starts at Home is the genesis of this, or really the impetus, that it looks like the use of proceeds in Subdivision 4 kind of counties and recipients are required to provide, to address a number of things in their plans. So I'm noticing, you know, targeting unaccompanied youth, providing rental assistance, et cetera. I don't know if that's all under Homework Starts at Home, but I guess I have the impression that it's a variety of things. And I may not get a chance for another follow-up because I know the time is maybe tight, but I guess I might just suggest it may make sense even from the start to target families, target, you know, pregnant women and families with children, rather than needing to necessarily, unless it really is limited to just Homework Starts at Home and really needs to be limited to school age. I just wonder if that might be something to consider, Chair Gomez, as the bill moves forward. Thank you, Madam Chair.
Thank you, Representative Pinto. Chair Gomez?
Yeah, thank you, Madam Chair, and thank you, Representative Pinto. That's actually a really good piece of feedback. And, you know, There's time to work on this, and I want to work with Representative Albright and with Representative New Brindley, who's the GOP lead on my committee, who offered this DE amendment yesterday. And after we spoke, she decided to withdraw it and not offer it because we're going to work together. So I actually, when I was looking at this, I know that there's sort of this like pre-K to, well, there's sort of like different ways to think about youth homelessness. We usually segment it to be 17 and under, and then like 17 to 24. And so I was sort of like curious about that because I know that we pulled the language from Homework Starts with Home, but I haven't like gone to double check it. So I'm open to expanding it to, to pregnant people or to younger kids, especially to your point, right? Like the Homework Starts with Home thing is really focused on, you know, getting resources into school districts that are dealing with the externalities of, student homelessness. But this, in bringing in the counties, it does expand our ability to kind of like maybe think about adding some priority groups. So I really appreciate that input, and I think I'm going to amend my bill to reflect that. So thank you.
Thank you, Chair Gomez, and being open to working with members on improving the bill. I'm not seeing any other questions or hands up from members. So Representative Albright, did you want to make another comment or question?
I do, members, and it's more of an observation. Look at what just occurred in the communication between Representative Pinto and Representative Gomez. This bill was introduced 2 days ago, but yet we already have bona fide, credible suggestions to make this bill better. But yet we're not doing them in this committee. In finality, we're making them suggestions. So where do we make those changes in the next stop, which presumably is tax, which is more about the code as opposed to HHS and early learning and homelessness, whether it, you know, the function, you know, the function of coming up as a division in through HHS or if it should be in housing, that notwithstanding that, I think the point that I'm trying to prove, point out to folks is we're not doing our job. We've got a limited amount of time. I understand that, you know, it's an hour and a half and we have to get things done. But if it's that serious of an issue, why not carve out time in the evening to talk specifically about this and have the opportunity for members to get together and coordinate and actually collaborate on amendments that are meaningful? Representative Gomez, I applaud this effort. I think this is a terrific initiative. Please understand that in terms of my comments. The one thing that I will note is I have heard ideas about that this is a bipartisan effort, but yet there isn't a single Republican co-author on this bill. If you want the support or at least the improvement of the bill from the Republican side of this committee as well as others, I would urge you to hold it in this committee or at least consider that an option before it moves to taxes. Notwithstanding times, I think you've got time on your side to get it done. But as I shared earlier, this is the committee where we need to do the work of Health and Human Services and not abdicate it to tax the tax committee. And with that, I just urge all of us to dig into this issue and make it as best as possible. Thank you.
Thank you, Representative Albright. And I know Chair Gomez is doing a lot of that work in her division, and they're doing a lot of that policy work, and the appropriation is in the tax division. And I hope you will work, Chair Gomez, I know you will, with our Republican colleagues to improve the bill and with our DFL colleagues. And I know Representative Pinto has his hand up. So Representative Pinto.
Thank you. Thank you, Madam Chair. And I guess I'll just note, especially since my name was invoked in that and the exchange with Representative Gomez, that I'm a little bit surprised or a little bit confused, because I'll note that in my terms in the House, the exchange had just happened, and then the idea of the bill continuing to change has moved to other committees is really, really standard practice, at least in my experience. I can't think of how often, even as a bill is heading to the floor, there's a conversation that says, where the bill's author says, yes, I'm going to be incorporating that in. This is an ongoing process that we all go through as bills move from one committee to another. I'll just note what's unusual, of course, this session is the tremendous, we are under a tremendous time and process squeeze. But taking that into account, I guess I really feel like what I'm seeing with this feels very much like what I've been seeing in my time at the legislature. And I really appreciate Representative Gomez for the continued dialogue, which I know is going to continue happening as the bill continues to move, because it has future stops. So thanks so much.
Thank you, Representative Pinto. I'm not seeing any other hands up from members. Representative or Chair Gomez, closing comments on your bill.
Thank you so much, Madam Chair, and thank you, members of the committee, for hearing the bill and for the good discussion today. Just a couple things. I don't think that Chair Schultz meant to imply that this particular bill has Republican authorship, but what she was talking about is the work that we've been doing in our division. And we have passed several bills out of our committee unanimously. We passed a bill out of our committee that I believe you will see soon, which is Representative Ryer's bill. I'm not sure if you've heard it or not, that costs money that we all agreed on. I personally feel, as you just expressed, Representative Albright, that caring about folks who are experiencing homelessness, caring about children who are experiencing homelessness is absolutely not a partisan issue. Every person on my committee has a heart for this work, and that's why they're there. And I know that you have a heart for this work, and that's why you're here. And so, I really have, I feel like I have a really great working relationship with Representative New Brindley, and we're going to dig in on this bill together. And I'm going to invite you to be a part of those conversations. I appreciated hearing from Representative Pinto kind of about because I'll tell you, I kind of come from an organizing background. The way that we do the work at the legislature is totally not the way that I do my work. It's not like, I like to collaborate. I like to have a lot of discussion. I like to move. We talk about moving at the speed of trust. I like to build trust with people and then move work with them. And I agree that it's unfortunate that we don't sometimes have the luxury of that time in the legislature. But also, I guess what I've been told is in the legislature, it's like you drop a bill and the committee process helps you make it better. And so that's what's happening here. And so I I'm just accepting the feedback that you've given me, Representative Albright, in that spirit of that you want to improve this bill, and I do too. I know it's not perfect. So, I just look forward to continuing the conversation with you, and thank you again for all the time today, committee and Madam Chair.
Thank you, Chair Gomez, and thank you, members, for being respectful of our time, and looking forward to seeing how this bill moves through and the improvements made in a bipartisan way. So with that, members, I'm going to renew my motion to re-refer House File 1791 as recommended to the Tax Committee. And we were going to roll call this vote. Ms. Hansen, are you ready?
I'm ready.
Chair votes aye.
Hopefully it goes better than attendance. Chair Schultz votes aye. Vice Chair Bonner?
Aye.
Bonner votes aye. Lead Albright?
Oh.
Albright, no. Representative Bolden?
Aye.
Bolden votes aye. Representative Burkle?
No.
Burkle, no. Representative Fisher?
Fisher, aye.
Thank you. Representative Frederick.
Aye.
Frederick, aye. Representative Hansen.
Hansen, aye.
Hansen, aye. Representative Keel.
Keel, no.
Keel, no. Representative Liebling.
Aye.
Liebling, aye. Representative Moeller.
Aye.
Moeller, aye. Representative Noor.
Noor, aye.
Thank you. Noor, aye. Representative Novotny.
Novotny, no.
Novotny, no. Representative Pearson.
Pearson, nay.
Pearson, no. Representative Pinto.
Aye.
Pinto, aye. Representative Rasmussen.
Rasmussen, no.
Rasmussen, no. Representative Robbins.
No.
Robbins, no. Representative Sandel.
Aye.
Sandel, aye. Representative Schumacher.
Schumacher, no.
So that would be Chair Schultz, 11. Are you there, sir?
Schumacher, no.
Thank you so much. Chair Schultz, that's 11 ayes and 8 noes.
Thank you, Ms. Hansen. And the motion passes and is adopted. So thank you, Chair Gomez. Thank you for your testifiers. We appreciate all the work you and your team is doing on the Division of Preventing Homelessness. And with that, members, I will see everyone tomorrow morning at 10:30. We'll continue our presentation of a few more PCA bills and continue to do the important work that I hope happens here and happens when we're not in committee. So thanks again, members. Have a great rest of your day. We'll see everybody tomorrow, and we are adjourned.